listener production.
Okay, are you recording?
G'day, and welcome along to episode 18 of the Howie Games. Great to have you listening. Now, this is the first of our BBL specials, featuring the biggest names of the tournament over the next month or so. We start with the captain of the Adelaide Strikers, Brad Hodge. Hodgie holds records galore in domestic cricket. In Test cricket, he averaged just under 56, with a top score of 203 not out. If you don't mind, amazing numbers. But the most amazing number of his career is 6. That's the number of tests Brad was selected to play. Go figure. In this ep, Brad openly discusses his non-selection, the T20 revolution, the seedy side of cricket, success, failure, and a lot more, all with a smile on his face. He is a very, very, very funny man, Brad Hodge.
Our man Hodgie has played 262 T20 games before this year's BBL. That's 7th all-time, Penguin. Thanks for stealing my thunder, Pickle.
Okay, Smarty Pants. Name all the teams he has played T20s for.
Easy, Pickle. Adelaide Strikers. Auckland. Australia. Australia A. The Barrasil Burners.
Where are they from?
Don't know. Don't interrupt, please. Guyana. Amazon Warriors. Kochi Tuskers Arala. Kolkata Knight Riders. Funny name. Lancashire. Leicestershire. The Basna Here Cricket Dundee.
You made that one up, Pengy.
No, I didn't, Pickle. Coached by old mate Dooley Mendes. But they've gone bust.
Probably paying Hodgie's wages. That's why they went bust.
Shh, Pickle. Melbourne Renegade. Northern Districts. Peshawar Zomri.
You're making all of those up, Pengy.
No, I'm not. Rajasthan Royals, St. Kitts and Never Patriots.
What?
Shh. Victoria and Wellington.
Wellington? Holy moly, Pengy. At my count, that's 19 teams.
He's a gun, my man, Hodgie.
Word.
Respect.
This episode was recorded in Florida during this year's Caribbean Premier League, a trip where Bradley Hodge offered to take a few of us out to dinner to Hooters. I think he was joking. Come on, Hodgie. Anyway, you wouldn't meet a nicer bloke than Brad Hodge. Super bat, funny chat.
Oh, my Jaja, tell me why won't they open up their eyes? They could help out if they try. If they would try.
Hodgie, great to sit down. In Florida, of all places, did you ever think you'd be playing cricket in Florida?
No, not at all. Not 22 years ago when I first started. It is actually the second time I have played cricket in the States. We had a Australia A tour here a long time ago, back with Ryan Campbell's on the tour, Andrew Simons. We played in LA, of all places, out in the middle of some sort of cow paddock. Wasn't really conducive for cricket, but 22 years down the track, I suppose, and here we are back in the States playing a game of cricket.
Do you see this as the future? We're here for the Caribbean Premier League. I know they're really keen on it, really keen on trying to engage this American market. I know that Cricket Australia's just done a deal for the Big Bash to pump, I think, 8 games live into America. Is it the way forward?
I think so. There's definitely a market here. I mean, that's been long talked about for a long time since the IPL started running, about how long it will take for people to come into America and try and attract that market. My hat's come off to the CPL guys to try and bring the games over here. Not that Florida aligns itself with the Caribbean too much, but it's somewhere close by. And it's a tough market to try and break into. You know, there's baseball and all sorts of other sports which the Americans are pretty keen on. But there are a lot of expats here who love the game of cricket, and it's really good that we're able to take that to them.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Let's go back a little bit. There's a few things I want to just sort of check off with you. Obviously, I've seen you and we've been in hotels now in Dubai and here in America and around the places, your teammates. Some call you Bradley.
Yeah,
some call you Hodgie, some call you Dodge, some call you Dodgeball. I understand all those ones. They make sense to me.
Yeah.
Bunky. I hear that on the effects mics occasionally. Bunky. What's
right.
Bunky? Who's Bunky?
That came about through a long time ago when I first played cricket for Victoria in 93, where I was still sleeping in bunk beds when I got selected to play for Victoria. So the guys, I think it was Dino that actually gave me the nickname, and then they just sort of ran with that. They thought it was quite funny at the time, you know, a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old playing cricket for their state and still sleeping in bunk beds. But hey, that's what the parents give you, and that's good enough, you know. So long as you get a good night's sleep at the end of the day. And that's how that one sort of came about. There's a few knocking around.
What was that like as a 17-year-old walking into that team? I guess Dino was in that team. Who else was there? Merv would have been in that
Merv
team.
Yeah, Merv was there. Fleming was in the first game I played. So was Warnie, actually. So the legends were there. I didn't really think about it too much at the time. I sort of felt that it just happened for me. I went to the cricket academy and, you know, there was legends already there. Glenn McGrath was there and a few other guys that were at that level. And I just sort of felt that I'd seen it and tasted what I think it was going to be like. I think the hardest part for me was the after the cricket game where, you know, you go out with Merv for some dinner or whatever and you know, one beer turns into six, you know, and you certainly can't keep up with the big fella. And that's sort of where it was quite difficult for a youngster to try and work out, you know, what was right, what was wrong, what the balance is. But my first year was a great memory because I remember scoring 991 runs, and then that sort of propelled me into, selection mode, I guess, where people started talking about the prospects of playing for your country and are you good enough and all those sort of things. And it took a little bit longer, but we got there in the end.
Were you good enough to play for Australia?
Yeah, definitely. And that says so. Whether you play only six tests or not, I'm very proud of that. I think that my road was quite difficult. I don't think it was easy at all. I think there's guys that I look around in sports and see that they've definitely, even cricket, have had easier rides than I've had. There's a lot of reasons for that. I certainly didn't have great role models at Victoria when I was coming through for those reasons that we just talked about. And I really didn't have the right direction and someone just to point me in that direction. And at that time, we only had a bowling quartet that were playing for Australia. I mean, Dino was in and out, but he was in his own different sort of world. And we didn't have any really other batsmen that, you know, had shown us the way or the playbook that to get you there to play Test cricket.
How do you mean he was in his own different world?
Well, Dino was, you know, he's known as the legend. He is the one-day sort of legend, and he was just off in some other, you know, stratosphere of cricketing gods.
Right.
Which sort of didn't lend us to us. Well, you know, there was guys like myself, Matthew Elliott, and that sort of needed just a playbook about this is how you do it. And Dino was great about talking about the game of cricket whilst you're actually playing. But the lifestyle in which they led was completely different to what we were used to as youngsters. You know, it just didn't really fit into what we knew as just suburban kids playing a game of cricket.
Your first test match against the West Indies, I'm not big on stats, but I was actually looking at the cricket info data here, and this is not something I usually do, but your first test match against the West Indies in Hobart, you made 60.
Yep.
What's your memories of that?
My memories was
match?
That I was robbed of a century because I got a crappy LBW decision
LBW.
Off Corey Collymore.
It's not that you're holding on to it.
Yep, and they're one of them things in sport where you look and you go, well, you know, imagine I turn that 60 into 120.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden in five games you've made a double century, 120, and you're probably averaging 65, and all those possibilities you can't get dropped. But that was probably the best I actually batted for Australia, that 60. Apart from the first ball, I think it was a sort of scunge to fine leg or something like that. The rest of the time I stroked the ball beautifully and hit the ball exactly how I wanted to. Got a crappy LBW decision and sent back. And I think from memory, McGill smacked another 30 or 40 after that. I was batting with him and he sort of said to me, I'll hang around with you. But he didn't get past the second new ball.
Is it as special as everyone says when you get the fabled baggy green cap?
It was for me because I felt that I'd got to a stage in my life where, and I know the time, it was about the time of 26, and I sort of had to make a decision whether I actually wanted to play for Australia or not, or not that I was ever not good enough. I never ever doubted that at all, and I don't think everyone else ever did. It was just the attitude. It was also you know, whether your application was right, whether you're doing the right things. And I just sort of flicked the switch and decided that everything in life I was going to try and do the right way. And that was everything from training to diet to lifestyle with your family. All these sort of things came into consideration. And I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to have a crack because I reckon I'll be really dirty with myself down the track if I don't give myself that opportunity. And I didn't want to be... I'm happy of being that guy that only played six tests and being the guy that was unlucky. He was great, but he just didn't play. So I didn't want to be that person. And so I made a conscious effort to try and be a lot better than what I was. And fortunate enough for me that happened. And I guess the byproduct of that is I'm really happy and proud of the stats which I've put together over the course of my cricketing life. You know, test match cricket, one day cricket. For Victoria, for T20s around the world. There's a lot of work that's gone into that, and I'm pretty proud of it. So,
well, those stats, you're the leading run scorer ever in Victorian Sheffield Shield history. You've scored the second most T20 runs in the world. Your test stats here, mate, we look at it. Six matches, 11 innings, two not out, 503 runs, a higher score of 203, and an average of 55.88. The only thing that doesn't make sense about that is six matches.
Yeah,
that makes no sense to me, Bradley.
Yeah, it hurts when people bring it up, you know. And I look back, and I've digested this many times.
I bet you have.
And the one thing which kills me a little bit is in those innings, I only ever got out below 23 twice. There was seven at the MCG and seven at the SCG.
Yep.
And for me...
There's a 41, yeah. A 27 not out, a 67, as well as a 203 not out against South Africa.
Yeah, those things, they sort of hurt, only because you feel when you get dropped that you're under pressure, you know, playing the game where you feel like you're out of form or... I just never felt that in any of the times that I actually played cricket. And one of the things that hurts is that if you read those numbers out... I thought that that's exactly what Australian cricket wanted from me, and I don't think I could be any better. So if you ask yourself the question, are you good enough to play Test cricket, then probably the answer is actually no, but that opinion is of the four people that choose the side, not the opinion of myself or anyone else around the world, because if you said to some young kid, mate, if you want to play cricket for Australia and you want to stay in the team, go and get yourself 500 runs in six games, and I'm pretty sure that'll be... Yeah, you know, on the track. Because that's what I said to the selectors. I said, well, I'm on track for 1,000 runs in a season. And only the legends do that. And that's what I couldn't understand at the time. And I sort of never have, actually.
Do you get anything back from the selectors?
No, I only ever got one thing, which was the only honest thing that I've ever had, apart from just keep going, make runs. That's pretty much the standard issue of, oh, keep going, mate, we know what you do. And... after a while, you just get sick of hearing that crap. It's a load of rubbish. But for me, yeah, where were we going?
There was one bit of honesty.
Yeah, one bit of honesty was David Boone. It was about a year down the track. I just found myself, I think we're in, after Australia, we're in Cairns, sort of Qantas Club, I reckon, or somewhere around there. Anyway, I just sat with him and I just had to ask. I said, mate, look, yeah, what happened? Why did I actually just get dropped? Was it because I nicked one, or was it that ball that I got, you know, should have just hooked it in Sydney, the last ball of the day where I got caught bat pad? And he just said, look, after a while, he just said, you know what, we just chose Damien Martin over you. Simple as that. For no reason. And that probably hurt even more, because at the time, Damien Martin was averaging 14 in Sheffield Shield cricket. But such a wonderful player.
And a good mate of yours.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can certainly vouch for that. And I'd probably vouch for my mate as well, you know, knowing that a guy had played 70 tests. But the one thing which I always I tell people personally, which I struggle with, is that the selectors didn't have the courage to say, you know what, yeah, we know Marto's a great player and he's a legend of the game, but, hey, this guy's come in and he's played five games for us and got 500 runs. And I think... we have to give that guy another chance. And that never happened. So, yeah, it breaks your heart, really. But, look, the way I sort of talk about it and get some reality and clarity about it is that, hey, that only played six tests, but it gave me a wonderful opportunity to take up another life in T20 cricket, travel around the world, you know, play really good cricket, contribute to all those teams around the world, all 18 of them, and make a difference. And that's important.
203. What are your memories of that 203?
All I remember is being on 199, and I remember thinking I'm pretty happy that Jacques Rudolph's bowling was. Because he was just a part-time leg spinner.
Yeah. You were, because you weren't your 90-odd not out overnight. Yeah, I remember watching, thinking, oh, it's going to be a tough night for him. He hasn't scored a first 100 and he's just short of it.
Yeah, I remember. And it was more just desperation the next day. You don't sleep. You just, you know, I think I was 94 or something like that.
So you don't sleep?
No, not much. And you're just sort of hoping that you'll find six runs somewhere. And I ran through it the whole time. I knew that... you know, I knew that Pollock could take the ball early and he'd probably have a crack at my stumps early. So just play straight. You know, do all the basics right and you'll be fine. Just trust your instincts and whatever. That was one of the hard things, actually, that I didn't reach 100 before stumps. They're one of the things in sport where you're sitting there with an over and a half to go and go, you know what, should I just take it on here and have it try and smack it over the top, and, you know? And you know you'll rest a lot easier knowing that you're 102 not out than 96. I'd probably do it now, but at the time it was just, you're going okay. You'll pick it up where you left off tomorrow and you'll be fine.
And bringing up the 200?
Yeah, 200 was... It's funny because one of the things that I'm when you say you played six test matches and I talk about it, it's not like there's six test matches, 120 runs, averaging 14 wasn't good enough. I'm very proud that there's something really significant for my country in those stats.
It's enormously significant.
Yeah, and it's something I'll be proud of forever in my life. I guess that's the conundrum for everyone, isn't it? That everyone comes up and it does heckle you after a while. You know, why haven't you played, or what? You know, you made 200, you got dropped after 200. You know, what have you done? What's happened?
Well, I sat here thinking, when do I ask Brad about the fact that he's had a brilliant career, but he should have played more? Is that the first question you ask, or is that the last question you ask? It's a tricky one.
Well, it is. But the way I look at it, who knows? I probably would have played 100 tests and I would have become really good looking and attractive to a lot of women around the world.
I'm not sure.
Found myself divorced and minus half my money anyway. So I figure it was probably a good thing just playing six.
Tell us about your wife, Meg. We were chatting about over cricket over dinner last night and I was asking you a lot of questions. And Eric, your coach out here, I was pestering him as well. But you said something interesting about that when, you know, you haven't made that many runs in this tournament and you ring your wife and she gives you a lot of clarity from the other side of the world about your cricket and a game that she doesn't know a great deal about.
Yeah, she's pretty honest. And I suppose that's the thing which I've always craved from people throughout my career, and most often you haven't got it, and she's the one that actually gives you the most honesty. And, yeah, I struggled on this tour. Really have for a bit of motivation. I know that I was awfully tired coming into this tournament as well, and there might be a fraction of burnout. I've been on the road since pretty much start of December, and here we are, you know, just touching the end of July. And she just sort of said, well, you know, look, you can't do it all the time. And, just as long as you try your best and make sure you give 100%, then that's all you can do. And you know that as well. But for me, 100% always means, you know, getting something on the scoreboard and contributing to the team. I'm just not used to, you know, coming. This is the first tournament, I reckon, where I've actually failed, which is okay. As long as you do your best and give it all.
Does it make you assess where you're going? We'll get to your coaching career soon, but does it make you assess where you're going as a cricketer?
Yeah,
or are you
definitely.
Now 42?
Yeah, I'm 42. 41 now.
41, a few greys just sprouting out the top
plenty,
there as well.
There's plenty of salt and pepper, yes.
and stylish.
Well, I used to diet, actually. I did used to dye the hair to try and... it was bluff, really.
At what stage was this?
This was probably for the last... 4 years.
Just for men style?
I've done the just for men. I can't say that the just for men works that well because you end up, your grey hair ends up turning into this blue-black type arrangement and you know that you just look like a vampire instead of a cricketer. But...
Has it been picked up on by
it's been picked up. Once I did it in I reckon I did it just before the Big Bash, about 3 or 4 years ago, and I clearly remember the dye running down into my forehead, and it was all about being current, you know. Like, people look at you, and if you're not, if my thing in sport is, how come you can be bald, and that's okay, and you're not old, yep. But if you're grey, you're old.
That's it.
It's the way it works, and I didn't like that. So I had two choices: either dye my hair or shave my hair off. And I didn't think I'd look too well with the hair shaved off, so I thought I'd dye it.
And that was because you didn't want to be perceived as getting older?
Yes. Yes, exactly. Because that's the thing. There's always the younger generation coming through, and they are very flamboyant, and that's always the thing in sport where you go, well, what's your lifespan? How long can you go on? And
so how long can you go on?
Well, not much longer, I don't think, for me. I think there's a number of reasons for that. It's just a compound of the batteries are just starting to run out, and you can't keep recharging them all the time. And there's family, and you know, my boy's 10 and my daughter's 7, and here we are in a hotel in Florida in the middle of nowhere. Mm. And these are the times where you're sitting on your own thinking, geez, I'm just wasting my time away here. But having said that, there's a lot more harder jobs out there in the world which aren't conducive to having a good day in Florida and making some money playing some sport which you love.
I think that's what people don't understand. I've got some idea of what it's like to live out of a bag in a hotel room. Like, you wake up this morning and, you know, an hour from here in Florida, and Erica, my partner, rang me this morning. He said, oh, there was a shooting in Florida. Are you okay? And it's like, the way the world's going, it's a bizarre...
It is.
You know, every morning you wake up now, how do you deal with the living in a hotel room? People find it hard to understand that it can be, how bizarre it can be, I reckon, living this lifestyle.
It's probably only one time in India where I really felt... I really felt I don't want to throw the word out there easily enough, depression was, yep. I wasn't depressed, but I certainly wasn't in a good state.
I sort of
felt the walls just, was that claustrophobic, and things weren't going well for me. And
when was this?
This was maybe in the first or second or third year of IPL, I reckon.
Yep.
And I'd been left out of the side. The team were travelling away. We didn't get to go with the team. We're just stuck in Kolkata at your hotel. And, you know, there's not a lot to do in India, let's be honest, outside of the hotels. They're beautiful hotels, but very much felt just a sense of loneliness. And we often joke saying that, you know, sometimes say that we're in the cricket prison and we just get let out to play a bit of sport every now and then.
Yeah, I can understand that.
It does feel like that sometimes. But, and that's where you sort of know that it gets hard. But you also know that it's very hard for this family back home as well. So you can't whinge and complain about it. You just get on and do your job and make sure that you're 100% committed to what you're doing. And if you're not, then toss it in.
Well, no one will listen to that whinge as well, because they'll say, look, you're highly paid, you're staying in a nice hotel, you got your life to yourself, your only decision is which eggs to have at breakfast. But
yeah,
it can be a very closed environment, can't it?
Yeah.
In some ways.
Yeah, and especially in this tournament, I mean, our team hasn't really socialised at all a lot. A lot of the West Indian guys don't even get out of their room. And I imagine how they're feeling. I know they sleep for 14 to 15 hours a day, if not more. And we're just not used to that. That's not part of our lifestyle. We're used to being active and getting out there and exploring and doing things. And sometimes these particular tournaments just don't allow you to do that. It's frustrating, but that's the way it works. It's got some great things about it. There's a lot of adrenaline rushes, which, you know, when you do return home to normal life, it does feel normal. And you got to get that sense of enjoyment back when you go home. Like always, most people say that the tournament's always 1 week long, because you just want to get home, and you miss home by the time you're finished, and energy levels start to run out. You know, you've been playing sport and you've tried mentally and physically, and then all of a sudden, you know, you can just run out of batteries.
So how do you stay at an elite level when you're feeling like that, when you're going out to bat and someone, Andre Russell's coming in at 145 clicks at Sabina Park, and, you know, they're going bananas around you?
Yeah, I've never sort of questioned that motivation. I've just always had it, but certainly this tournament I've questioned it. And that's where I know that it's not far away from the end, because my choice now is to run away from it, not take it on. Unfortunately, that's the reality. Unfortunately, that's where it's at. Normally, I'd get out there and go, right, come on, Andre, let's have a piece of this and whatever. But my mind and where I'm at the moment is just, sorry, but it's not quite there. Do my best to get around it, but the ambition level's not 100%. But the thing that's funny, I've realised that, you know what, I just have to get, I'm going to really train hard and give it one last real red hot crack at the Big Bash, because I know that tournament is important for me, and I really want to win a title before I finish. I reckon that'd be pretty cool.
Couple of semi-finals the last couple of years.
Yeah, and it's interesting. These tournaments, you're here in spirit and body, and when you're here, you buy into it, and you want to win for the franchise and whoever you represent. But it's never important as your home tournament. Your home tournament is your home tournament. So. It is, everyone gets up for it and everyone's engaged and involved, and it's great fun. Where here, it is a different environment, and it does lend itself to different motivations, I suppose.
We're talking about the hotel rooms. A legendary rumour that floats around the cricket circuit, and you can tell us whether it's true or not, is that sometimes you slide down to breakfast, you don't even really bother to get out of your pyjamas.
That's been put to bed, that. I used to. I sort of figured that, well, I've been a while. I figured that this is my home, you know, somewhat.
But you don't normally have 100 people at breakfast at home.
No, true. And look, it got put to bed one day.
So you would be in your jammies?
Normally.
At the breakfast buffet?
Yes.
What type of jammies?
They're Calvin Klein. So they're good quality.
Good. Like long sleevers? Long?
Nah, shorts and T-shirt.
Okay.
And probably the slippers that, you know, you find in the wardrobe. they always get a good run. But it got put to bed, actually. My wife came on tour with me to the UAE when we were playing in the IPL. And I went to breakfast in the Calvin Klein boxer shorts and T-shirt. Anyway, she came back and she wasn't ready to go to breakfast. And she basically had a go at me when I walked in the room about my attire, about going for breakfast. And I said, well, honey, that's just what I do. So she just basically said, well, put her lingerie on and started walking out the door. And I said, well, where are you going? She goes, well, I'm going to breakfast. And I said, well, no, you can't do that. It's not. And we just sort of had some dialogue about, you know, what's right and what's wrong. And that was sort of the last day I ever did it. And it took my wife there to be on tour. Otherwise, it'd probably just be the same. I'd still be wandering around in breakfast in the Calvin Klein cut-off shorts.
A short break from Hodgie for a moment. Next Thursday on the Howie Games, another big-name cricketer. Could be Kumar Sangakkara. Could be Pete Siddle. Possibly Ricky Ponting. Or maybe someone else entirely. Anyway, please continue to give us your feedback on Facebook or Twitter at MarkHoward03. And if you could, give us a rating on iTunes if you have the time. It helps our cause enormously. Please also continue to tell everybody you know, and I mean everybody, about the Howie Games. Back to Hodgie. T20 cricket, what was the first time you played it? Because I want to get into T20 with you because, as I said, you know, you've played, I think, the second most games and the second most runs behind Chris Gayle. What was the first game of T20
you played? First game was Leicestershire versus Yorkshire in 2004, I reckon, or 2003, at beautiful Grace Road. And I remember it was the first game ever played, or first game professionally ever played, and I scored 98. Not out, I think. And I remember the next day, Ian Harvey was playing for Gloucestershire.
The Freak.
Yeah, the Freak. And he got 100. And he messaged me and he sort of said, you know, suck eggs, have some of that. I got the first T20 100 and you didn't. And I remember it clearly because Leicestershire wasn't the most vibrant place in the world for cricket. And in fact, it was quite dull. It's a dullish sort of area. And, you know, you just get your locals watching four-day cricket. Anyway, this T20 match, we rolled in and it was jam-packed full of people. You know, people just drinking pints, having a good time. The music was blaring. And it was just a good product and a good show. And that, I knew straight away that was going to be the future.
You did?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I'd love playing it myself. And I think it lends itself to actually what the sport's all about. And that's actually hitting a ball. The idea of the sport is to hit a red cricket ball or white cricket ball or whatever colour it is now, pink. And that T20 just lends you to do that. The idea is to hit it and hit it as far as you possibly can most times, or we always skill. And that's what I loved about it. He didn't leave the ball too much. He just, that was the idea. You see it and you try and hit it.
So this is, you're playing here for the Patriots.
Yeah.
St. Kitts and Nevis.
Yes.
Which, for those that aren't aware, is a combined two little islands out in the Caribbean Sea. What number team's this?
I think it's actually 18.
18.
Yes. 17 or 18.
Have a crack at naming them.
Okay. So we've got to start from the top. Australia, Victoria, Stars, Renegades, Strikers, Barisal Burners.
Where are they from?
That's Bangladesh.
Right.
Something like Cricket Dundee in Sri Lanka. Durham, Leicestershire, Lancashire. Auckland Aces, Wellington Firebirds, and Northern Districts. Where are we? St. Kitts Patriots, Amazon Warriors.
Now we're in the Caribbean.
Mm.
So we've left a couple out.
Somewhere along the line. Did I miss the Renegades out?
No, you threw the Renegades in. Do you keep a shirt from every team?
Yes, I do.
Right.
That's probably the only part of memorabilia I actually keep.
Right.
And they're not really put in any specific place or order. They're just, I actually went through the garage the other day and it was quite funny. I pulled out a few shirts. I was just trying to clean it up and there was like my East Sandringham Cricket Club. There was Barisal Burners. There was Auckland Aces. And you know, I just sort of threw it out there on Twitter and said, wonder which one was the most fun to play for.
Talk about the, before we get to the coaching side of it, how do you prepare and how do you gel as a team when you roll in and you've got fellas from different countries, different cultures, different languages, some that you've had a go at on a cricket field before, some that you instantly haven't liked when you played against them. You're stuck together as 11 blokes with limited preparation and said, all right, let's go out there and operate as a unit.
It's difficult. And that's the whole thing about sport. It's about continuity and knowing your partner and knowing, you know, what makes those guys tick. And that's why I guess turnover in footy clubs and all that, there's only five to seven in a year to try and keep that core group together. That's the hardest thing with these sort of tournaments is that, you have to get to know someone pretty quickly. You have to get to know their game. And if they don't, you pretty much fail.
Yeah.
That's the reality. Different in the IPL in Australia where people tend to stay where they are and people know their games already. We only have two overseas, so we already know that they're legends. We pretty much know what they do. Whereas here, it's completely different.
Talking to your coach last night,
yeah,
Eric, and he was saying you nicked off to the loo at dinner, and he said, oh, my impressions of Brad was he'd be a really quiet bloke. I didn't really warm to him. I didn't know him, and now my idea of it is completely different. What he's like now that he's coaching with you and working with you, has there been players, has there been a player that you've thought, oh, I really don't want to play with this bloke, and he has surprised you or hasn't surprised you?
Not really. No, I think I've only ever come across guys where my opinions have just been ramped up.
Right.
Someone like Murali Dhuran,
yep,
where I wasn't sure what he was going to be like, and you know, he'd gone through a lot of hard times with his action and stuff, and I didn't really know what he was going to be like as a human being. And when I played with him, it was the most wonderful experience I could ever think of. Such a vibrant, funny guy. And he'll just be, he will know every stat about sport known to man. He'll know that, South beat, the Broncos on the weekend or whoever it is.
Does
and
he?
You go, how do you know that, man? You know, we don't even follow it. We're from Melbourne. And he'll just reel it off and, he'll talk about some guy who plays for Man City football, and he just knows stats left, right, and centre. And it's such an infectious, funny guy. I just didn't see that coming. But there hasn't really been anyone that I haven't liked on the cricket field. I think that over time, it just doesn't happen anymore. The game has certainly softened. One of the things I was really looking forward to was the Shikhar Dhawan, David Warner relationship at Sunrisers Hyderabad, to see how that played out. Because I remember them two going pretty hard during the Test series in Australia a couple of years ago. But as you said, it all works out in the end and people know what makes them tick and you move on. And so these friendships in cricket now, which actually has lended itself to a real lesser contest, I think.
With your Test career, at the time when you were dropped, it was reported, whether it was rumour or people just couldn't understand that you weren't in the side, that maybe you hadn't got on with some of your teammates. Yeah. Did you see it like that or not?
No, not at all. The way I've digested that and think about it...
You're obviously aware of that being
written. Yeah, I was. And I know that there was a report made in the 2007 World Cup by Steve Bernard back to Cricket Australia. And I found this out a lot later, which I wanted to actually really... hurt someone when I found this out.
He was the team manager?
Yeah, he was. And if you cast your mind back to that, we won the tour. It was a long tour. We were here for 10 weeks in the West Indies. And I just sort of got back into the one-day side. And Sean Tate was here as well. And in that time, we were the only two which didn't bring our families across to the West Indies. One was that, A, I couldn't afford it. And two... is that I said to my wife, you know what, I just need to get back into this team. I need to socialise with these guys. I need to mix. And I thought that was quite important. I got here and, as I said, we were the only ones without partners. And I found out that in that report it said that Brad didn't quite socialise enough with the guys. He went off scuba diving on his own. He did a few things on his own and really didn't quite mix with the team. And I found that... devastatingly frustrating, because all I wanted was that to happen. But as I said to Steve Bernard or someone later on down the track in a Cricket Australia meeting, I said, what do you think I had to do? Ring up Ricky Ponting and say, mate, do you think you and Rihanna can take me out for dinner tonight and go and hang out? Michael Clarke, what are you and Lara doing tonight? Mm. And I've never been so disappointed in my life on that analogy. And I reckon it's the biggest downfall ever of John Buchanan. That's where he let me down 100%, because he was meant to be a guru of the psyche of people and what makes them tick. And all I was ever craving out for was a bit of love and attention and a bit of friendship from everyone. But the problem was, I was the only Victorian on the side. And I've said this to Cameron White and David Hussey, is that it's bloody hard when you're the only person on tour. Because naturally, we conform in our own groups, which we know. You've seen it here where the West Indies just conform, the Pakistani guys conform, we conform. Absolutely. As Westerners.
Yep.
And that was the hardest thing. And I remember clearly in that time, Sean Tate went home and said he was depressed. It wasn't depressed. He was just lonely. He was craving the same things that I wanted. I remember him flying his brother over about halfway through the tournament, just because he was doing exactly what we're doing at the moment, bored out of our heads. Mm. But he's a young kid and he wasn't able to break in to the family orientation with Mel and Adam Gilchrist and Kelly and Matthew Hayden. I just didn't see it. And it kills me and it devastates me to know that I went through all these psych evaluations with John Buchanan, wasting my time so he can understand what sort of person I am, and I was screaming at him in front of him, and he let me down big style.
Did you tell him?
No, I never have. But I certainly jump on... I don't think it's important. I really don't. But I certainly know that when Warnie makes comments about him, I certainly don't stand up and say, you know what, he was a great coach. I can't see it at all. All he did was challenge the best cricketers in the world to be the best, and they were the best by a mile. But, yeah, that was one thing which not many people actually know, where I reckon I was let down pretty severely by management and actually guys in the upper echelon of the cricket fraternity.
Who was the best cricketer in the world you've ever seen?
I reckon Virender Sehwag.
Is he?
Yeah, I think that the ability that he has to win a game of cricket or to turn a game of cricket, everyone says Sachin and everyone loves the way Sachin bats, but I think that Virender, with his record and what he achieved, is absolutely outstanding. He dominated.
Changed the game.
Yeah, he dominated. The other one was probably Lara as well, probably the best player of spin that, you know, has ever come around and dominated Murali, you know, at times, and that just doesn't happen.
You get on with him?
Brian?
Mm.
I only met him once, and he wiped me. Mm. Didn't give me much at all. Maybe it was because of the fact that I got him out. Yes.
In?
Australia A versus West Indies. I said that Marto was the captain, actually.
This is better than a 200 versus South Africa.
Correct. So I joked to Damien Martin when he was the captain of Australia, I said, mate, I'll get this guy out. Give me the ball. And anyway, 217 runs later, Marto chucks me the ball. Anyway, first ball, come on the bowl to BC Lara. Nick, first slip out, caught.
And he's on what?
217. And I said to Marto, told you, mate, what did you waste 6.5 hours for? I could have got him out 6.5 hours ago. I told you I was going to get him out. And it was one of the things, and they actually end up getting 4 for 17. It was pretty funny, including the great BC Lara. It was probably one of the highlights of my cricketing life.
Maybe that's why it wiped you, mate.
Probably. He knows. He knows it was there.
Let's go to Dubai in February. And for fans of the IPL, the idea now is to try and get people to explain what actually and understand what goes on over there. So February, you're playing in Dubai in a Masters League event, which, as an aside, some people still haven't been paid for.
Yeah.
How does that sit with you when you go on? You're still owed money from, is it Kochi?
Kochi Tuskers,
Can you give us an idea? I don't know whether you account or not, how much money they owe you?
I know exactly how much they owe me.
Can you tell us?
Yeah, it's $165,000.
There seems to be a fair... That what amazed me, going to Dubai and talking to... There was people weren't getting paid and players were threatening to go on strike, and I'm not sure if this is public knowledge or not, but it should be. And players, Dirk Nana said to me, oh, mate, this Bangladesh is what you... This is what happened. I was owed money here. If you just get 75% of what you're owed, well, it's been a good result. It was a whole new world to me, because to me, if you're going somewhere to work and you're going to get paid $10, you get paid $10.
Yeah, that's what we're used to in Australia, unfortunately. But unfortunately, in these part of the world, that's not the way it works, often or not. You hope that honesty comes through, but it's not the way it operates.
$150,000.
Yes, a lot of money.
How do you deal with that?
Not easy, because at the time, like all Australians do, is they project. And we went and built a house and put some money into a renovation. And the reality is, I'm $165,000, at the time the exchange rate was about 90, actually $175,000 out of pocket. So I now pay 6% on that money, which I haven't got. But what do? You can't jump up and down, because, as people say, if you make a big fuss about it and upset City Hall, then it's not that easy. But there's a lot of big players owed some money, and I find it hard that they haven't got the courage to actually get out there and try and get it.
James Sutherland wrote a letter on your behalf.
He did, which was a really nice thing. And I just asked him, I said, well, I've sort of come to just a roadblock, hit a T-junction, and I just don't know where to go. And I sat with him and I explained to him, mate, I've got a wife and two kids and I've been slugging it out for a long time, and I just can't let $165,000 slide through to the keeper. I've worked hard for that money and it's owed to me. And unfortunately, there's just no way to get to the top of it or bottom it or get a straight answer about that. But I remember all the guys on that tour, jumping up and down and make a song and dance about it. And I just thought, you know what? You guys never had this problem because you didn't play 2020 cricket, but this is a reality in a lot of leagues around the world. Yeah, well, that's where I don't want to criticise too much, but that's where I think FICA and their cricketing body are a complete waste of time,
because they're not doing what
they need to do. Their job. Their job is they're a players' union, and if they can't hustle down what's best for the players, I've sat with FICA and they've just got no power in India, which
FICA
is a waste. Federation of International Cricketers Association.
Right. So they represent you guys on an international stage.
Well, they're basically the governing body which oversee all the local ones. So for us, it's the ACA, the Australian Cricketers Association, and we fall under that banner. Look, I sort of feel that, we pay our subs and we're in a union, and if a player is out of pocket or out of favour, then I think it's their job to go and fetch it for us or help us get it in any sort of way, and I just think there's fallen over way too easy.
Will you ever see the 165 grand, do you think?
No idea. I've been told by certain BCCI officials yes, and I'm hopeful that'll happen, and it'll be a nice little surprise when it comes.
Yeah.
I hope so, because that's money I've actually earned and played for, but we'll see.
More of Brad Hodge in a moment. Now, if you haven't subscribed to the Howie Games, please do, and then you'll get every episode on your device every single Thursday morning. You won't miss any of the likes of Adam Gilchrist, Danny Green in the back catalogue, Brendan Favola, Darren Sammy, Dennis Cometti, Jack Jones, Larry and Jack Perkins, Dean Jones, Mick Doohan, Jim Cassidy, Michael Clark, Ange Postecoglou, Jake Edwards, Greg Norman, Lane Beachley, Damian Martin. How about some of those names? And last week's guest, Trevor Hendy. This is a man who dominated his sport of Ironman. He's been bankrupt. He surfed some enormous waves. He is currently changing people's lives. But to top all that, the great man has starred alongside Pamela Anderson on Baywatch.
That was actually the day that Nikki Sixx was dating, what's her name? They're married still.
Right.
And he bought Tommy Lee.
Tommy Lee.
He brought Tommy Lee down to have a double date, and I was actually standing there with Jonathan Crowe and Pamela Anderson talking. And we're talking, and we just filmed the bush, the campfire scene or the beach fire scene and everything else, and we just finished and they were there. And I was standing there when he walked over and introduced the two of them, and I met him as well. And I'm like, oh, and then she was like, see ya. And off they went for their date, and that was it. So, and there's another story to that because she was, I'm not going to go into that, but she was dating a friend of mine at the
time. Right. Well,
and Tommy Lee came and cut his grass.
Right.
So.
Catch up with the back catalogue when you get a moment. All right, time to go back to Brad Hodge. Sitting there in February in Dubai playing the Oxygen Masters Champions League. You're about to also go and play in a different comp in Dubai, the Pakistan Super League. So you were playing for two teams within 3 days in the same country in two different tournaments. You were on and off the phone trying to get your first big coaching job in the IPL, which is a massive deal. Explain to us the process of becoming a coach of the Gujarat Lions in the IPL.
Okay, so the process was probably a little bit more random than any normal job. I was sitting here last year in the Caribbean Premier League with Venky Mysore, who's the Kolkata Knight Riders Chief Executive Officer, and Trevor Bayliss had just left his post and gone to England, and I sort of mentioned to him that I'd like the opportunity to have a crack at trying to get the head coaching job or an assistant coaching role at Kolkata Knight Riders. And it didn't sort of pan out. He'd already had his idea of where he wanted to go and stuff like that. And he gave me the number of the owner of the new Gujarat Lions team. So I rang him up and explained to him that I was interested. And that's where it started. And we're in the middle of the Big Bash. I was in South Australia, and he rang me up, or I kept messaging him. He said, you know what, go and see my brother who lives in Melbourne. He sort of runs that side of the business there. There's four brothers, and there's one in Hong Kong, one in Dubai, one in India, one in Melbourne. He said, fly over. He said, all our brothers have an equal share and say in, you know, how we run our businesses and stuff. So if you go over there, have a chat to him, he can then, make a report back to me, and we go from there. And I sort of said, mate, do you want me to fly over to India? You know, I thought, because I knew that face to face, I knew that people would like me and you know, see a different person to what they've seen before, or present in a different way. And it was actually vitally important. We met him at is it the Holiday Inn, I think, in Glen Waverley or Novotel it is.
Near the Glen Shopping
Centre. That's it. So we met there and gave him a presentation. And
which is what?
Which was basically how to sell myself to the Gujarat Lions. And my selling point to them was that, well, you're only here for 2 years. Your goal must be to stay in the competition. So I said to them that I'll try and present a flamboyant team which will make the BCCI or someone else after 2 years go, hey, we need these guys staying in the competition because we love everything what they represent. That was my big selling point, really. And then we went about how we're going to do it. And it worked. Bluffed them beautifully, as I say. For me, it was a really important job. I wanted to do it. I felt that, coaching away from what I know in Australia, and that was a really good opportunity. I'd love the IPL. I'd always been involved in it as a player, and I thought to be a coaching, it was, which only lasts for 2 months as well, would be, pretty good.
You had a day or two off from Dubai from the games, from the Gemini Arabians.
Yeah.
There's a team you missed out.
The Gemini Arabians, yes.
With Verinder Sehwag.
Yes, of course.
And
why would not?
So you dashed over to India. you got your visa. I remember you having trouble getting a visa.
Yeah.
You dashed over to India, you signed the contract and came back, and then you were showing me your phone at breakfast after it was officially announced around the world that you were the new coach of the Gujarat Lions. Mm. Tell me about what was going on your phone.
Well, I remember laughing because there's guys who I hadn't seen for 5 to 6 years telling me that the leg spinners are coming out pretty well, the wrong ones are good, their economy rates, I'm bowling well, I'm hitting the ball, I'm training hard, so I think you should stick the paddle up for me. And I remember chatting to Ricky later on, and he sort of said, yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, he said, it's amazing how many people come out of the woodwork when he got the Mumbai Indians job, and there was people ringing up, do you need a bowling coach, do you need a fielding coach, mate, I'm playing well, you know. And I remember thinking the same thing myself when I was a player and seeing Ricky in the Big Bash and thinking, well, you know what, is there any chance, you know.
Yeah.
it's just a way forward and a way to get in. And lucky enough, I think the reality is for me, like always, I just did it myself, and it's always been that way. And the irony is that it came about doing it myself, and I'm glad that happened that way. And then moving to the auction was a pretty crazy week leading into that auction in, I think it was February 7, I reckon.
We hear about the auction.
Yeah.
It streams online in Australia, and all we see is the money.
Yeah.
You know, that Faulkner's gone for $900,000 or Watto's gone for, you know,
$2 million.
How does that money strike you?
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah. It's phenomenal, isn't it?
Oh, it's ridiculous.
But good luck.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as long as it's filtering around into cricketers' pockets, it's great.
So how do you put it together? You sit there, you've got a blank canvas?
Yeah, I didn't know at the time that we had a budget, I think, of around $5 million, but I didn't know at the time that we were only going to spend 2.5. So I sort of got halfway through the auction, and the owners had said, well, we're nearly done here. And I said, oh, that's...
Hang on, we've got 2.5 left.
Something I didn't know.
So what was happening to the other 2.5?
Well, there was just savings. For them, it was just a calculation of, we don't need to spend that money. So for them, it was more of a business transaction than it was... for me, I just tried to put the best team possibly together.
So you put the paddle up?
No, I didn't put the paddle up. The owner put the paddle up.
Right.
In which he was actually quite good at. We already had our names written down who we were going to go for, and second and third options. And I think it was a compromised auction in the fact that everyone else had already got most of their players. So it was quite difficult for the Pune side and our side, who only had 5 players at the start, whereas everyone else probably had a core group of 16 to 17.
Yep.
So they actually only really needed 1 or 2 or 3 players. We needed 15 or 16. So there was some where you just have to take a loss and go, we want that guy, but hey, these guys... they're just going to go harder and harder because that's their one hole and they need to fill that hole.
Talking about that hole, you know, you said Watto went for $2 million.
Yeah.
There was someone told me in Dubai coming out of that the team that bought Watto were prepared to go a lot more than $2 million.
Yes.
Did you hear those rumors?
Yes, and I know that for a reason, because Dan Vittori is a good friend of mine, came in the morning and Vijay Mallya, who was still involved at the time
with
RCB, Royal Challengers Bangalore, came to Dan and says, right, we've got $4 million to spend. We're going to spend it all on Shane Watson. If it costs us $4 million, we're going to get him. So Dan had his ideas that, well, that can't work because we actually still need a wicketkeeper.
Well, what, I can't do that when he's bowling.
And in his plans was to get Dinesh Kartik, who was in our plans as well. So he went and traded off someone else for a wicketkeeper at 6:30 in the morning to make sure that he got KL Rahul, who's a part-time wicketkeeper. He actually had a great tournament. Which opened it up for me to get Dinesh Kartik.
Right.
And that's how we actually got Dinesh Kartik. Otherwise, we wouldn't have got him. They would have just paid another $1 million for him.
So Watto could have gone for...
He could have gone... if someone else wanted him, he would have gone for $3.5 million. Or kept going until there was 2 people out of the race.
Wow.
And that's what happened.
Like buying a house in Melbourne.
Well, I'm pretty sure Watto doesn't need any more houses. Oh, every time I read the Sydney paper, he's selling a house left, right and centre.
So you've got your squad together.
Yeah.
Congratulations on what happened, because for those that aren't aware, you had a fantastic tournament. You got to the, you know, you made the finals. You were one game short of playing in the final.
Yeah.
tell us about the campaign for a start. Aaron Finch, who hadn't been making many runs, came and made runs. Yeah. Lots of runs.
Yeah, he did well.
So what do you say to Finchie as a coach? Now you're a coach, as a bloke you know, you've played with. How do you get the best out of Aaron Finch?
Well, the thing was I knew him personally as well. So it was quite funny because the thing was I always wanted to pick Finchie up, but the owner stuck the paddle up for Dwayne Smith first and he stuck the paddle up for Kevin Peterson as well, and which it didn't fall into our plans. He just got excited.
And so they weren't on the list.
No, and fortunate enough, Dwayne Smith was, but Kevin Peterson wasn't. Anyway, he went to about 700,000, I think, for KP and then pulled the pin and Pune ended up getting him, which threw us off a little bit because Finchie came up next and then nothing happened. And I got a message from Finchie on the phone, said, "What's happened, mate? Is the paddle stuck to the table, isn't it?" And I just said, well, patience, my friend, because as I said, we had to put together 14 players. And if we already had Dwayne Smith there and we already had Brendan McCullum, then it sort of shut the door on Finchie a little bit. And lucky enough, it went through and we were always going to go back to Finch or Khawaja or someone like that to back up McCullum and Dwayne Smith. Anyway, I always wanted Finchie, and luckily enough, Suresh Raina wanted Finchie as well. And he came back in the second round of the auction. We put his name down, and the paddle goes up, and Finchie comes to us, which was great.
For
$200,000. So it was his base price, which, you know, still it's good money. You know? It's amazing money. And that's what I said to him later on, you know, that he thought that, you know, like all Australians that probably think they should go for a bit more money than they should. And I said, well, mate, you're here. That's the main thing. It could be worse. Could not be here. And I just sort of, he went through a bit of a hard patch, which I could really sympathise with that, where he lost the captaincy for the T20 side, which I didn't agree with
at Australia.
The time. Yeah, I didn't agree with at all. And I thought the timing of it was just terrible as well. It was leading into a tournament, you know, one of the biggest tournaments in the world. And you know, and then he was actually, his place was in jeopardy to Khawaja. And I just sort of said to him, mate, look, just know that once you go to the T20 World Cup, whether you play or not, go there and train hard because you're gonna walk up and start the first game. I'd already made that decision that I was going to choose Finchie sort of over Dwayne Smith for no other reason than I knew that I could just trust him to get 100% out of him. And I just wanted to free him up. And I just said, mate, go and I've watched you for the last 6 months and you really just played a bit more a reserve game than what Finchie's used to. He was just trying to carry the side for the Renegades and also for Australia, where he'd batted deep into, you know, the 16th or 17th over and he got 75 or so. But I think the real benefit of Aaron Finch is getting 40 off 20 balls at the top. Just that power and that strength, which people just around the world don't have. Apart from the West Indians, Finchie, I reckon there's a couple of guys, you know, Cameron White, they've just, now Chris Lynn, just got the ability to hit the ball into the stand. And that's what I wanted to get back across to him, say, mate, when you walk out the bat, people are scared of your talents, of not your cricketing ability, it's the way you hit the cricket ball. So let's bring that back to the party and let's get out there and just flog it and have some fun, mate. And then what happens will happen. See what happens. And it was really good. He really came and he was really engaged in the group and felt really wanted and a big part of it. And he's a big player, of course. And I just kept saying to him, mate, your list is the best T20 player in the world. And there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
So let's go and show him. That's it. Get out there and show him. As soon as you walk to the crease, everyone knows you're the best. Just go and show him.
And it worked for him.
Yeah, it did. And he actually took on a different role as well. He got injured. He did his hamstring again. And then Dwayne Smith came in and he pumped it everywhere. And I ended up moving him to the middle order, which was a different role for him. And he actually really enjoyed it. And I had to sit down there and talk to him about it because probably one of the things on a player like that is your ego. No, you know, I'm an opening batter. I get out there and flog it. And I said to him, well, this could open up a new door for you like it did for me at Rajasthan Royals. I was a top order player. And, you know, they saw a different role for me for a different reason. I said this, you know, that log jam at the top of the Australian T20 side, this could open up a spot in the end where you know, guys like you hit it out of the park consistently is a real benefit. Mm. And he took that on board really well, and it worked for him, which was great.
So as a coach in the IPL, how many different directions do you get pulled in by owners that are supporters, that are fans, that pay the bills? How do you keep the whole thing on track? Because I don't think we really understand in Australia. Ricky Ponting explained to me, he said, you've got to go to the IPL, Howie, because every game is like the AFL Grand Final. Mm. He said every game is the attention and the pressure and the crowd. How do you keep it all on track?
It's amazing. It is. It's amazing. Our reality was that walking into the tournament, I just sort of said, we need to win 8 out of 14 games. You win 8, you're in the finals. So that's reality. So you have to embrace losing as well, to know that, okay, we just have to get back on track. You are going to lose from time to time, but if we win 8 out of 14, so, you know, with the list of players we got, that's just over 50%. It should be achievable for sure. And I always felt that. And the thing is, you just go through fluctuations of motivation and where your body's at and your level. And as you said, it is like a grand final every time you play. So imagine playing a grand final and getting up for it the next day, and then the next day, and then the next day. It just can't. It's not possible. It just takes a hell of a lot of energy, and that's from everyone.
Do the owners get involved? Do they start saying, "Brad, I think you should pick this guy. I think you should pick that guy"? And how do you deal with that?
No, he was really good, and it was probably the fact that he was actually 24 years of age.
The owner?
Yes, he was a 24 years of age billionaire
from
Delhi.
How did he make
from,
his billions?
From communications, from phones. So their company's Intex Communications. They basically sell all through the regional areas of India. So if you think of Samsung and Apple, they're probably attractive in Bangalore, Mumbai.
Right.
But if you think of the vast majority of billion people in India, they can't afford $600 or $700 for Samsung or iPhone 7 or 6. They buy Intex for $150, which is exactly the same model or same phone, does exactly the same, just that it's cheaper.
So do these guys flaunt their wealth? Like, do you go to their house and or their car and be blown away? Or
no, when I met with a guy in Dubai, he picked me up in a Rolls Royce Ghost, and that's they're the things which sort of look and you go, wow.
And okay, you love cars.
Look, these guys were great. They were very modest. They came from pretty much zero to $3 billion.
Wow.
It's a pretty phenomenal story. You know, from his father just working in a local tech store with one computer to now, you know, that's 20 years ago. And their story was great. The problem was we heard it the day before the semi-final. the father thought that it was a really good idea that he come and show his face for the first time and tell the players exactly, you know, how Intex had... And I was sitting there, this is one of the biggest games of the tournament, and he drifted on for about 20 minutes. And it's one of them things where you're standing there and going, this is the owner, this is the guy that pays your bills, but I have to cut him off here.
Mm.
And I walked up and just said, thanks, mate, that's great. But, you know, we've got a career game to win. It's great that you've told us that you've got how many houses around the world and your 9 Rolls Royces around the world, but hey, we need to get out there and flog a few tonight. So. It was one of them things where the whole team just had their hands in their heads because they just wanted to get into the sport, you know, and the last thing they needed at the time was to be told about the whole life story of Intex Communications. But the point was, the guy just was trying to motivate the team in the right way. But, yeah, that's my job. I'll leave that to me and we'll tell the story later. It was a pretty important day.
Why don't the Australian T20 team have the same success that they have in every other form?
One is continuity as well. So, as I said, I remember we had a great Victorian T20 side only because we know that, hey, Hodgie walked out the bat with Bobby Quiney and Finchie came in next and Huss came in next and Cameron White came in next and Andrew McDonald came in next. Yeah. And we just knew exactly what we did. And it's just like the Hawthorn Football Club, you know, they're just structure. That guy plays there. This is what he does. This is where he moves. And everyone just knows and it just flows and it goes well. I've lost track there.
The Australian T20 side.
Yes, they don't get that opportunity to gel and work out exactly. They know people's strengths and stuff, but they don't really know in T20 how everyone reacts when they're under pressure. Okay, so what does Mitchell Marsh do when he's under pressure and he's facing Amit Mishra and they're 5 for 100 with, you know, 6 overs to go? How does he react? And how does he react to the guy at the other end? They just don't get an opportunity to play together enough. And I think they only had maybe 5 or 6 games leading into the T20 World Cup. They went to South Africa and again, the side's changing around, trying to find the right combinations. Fincher plays and then Warner plays and then Gawaja plays. Smith bats at 4, then Smith bats at 3. All these things are unknown to the guys going into the tournament. And most of us like simplicity or knowing where we stand. And I just don't think that they get enough opportunity to play either domestically or even internationally to become better. Or we don't have that time frame to make them better. We don't have, you know, enough dialogue with AJ Tye to go, okay, well, you're going to play for Australia in the next 6 months, 5 times. What exactly are you working on to be, you know? You played that one day game for Australia, but your T20, you know, you got your slow ball got hit. What happened? What were your thought processes after that? You know, you went to the T20 and then you didn't bowl your slow ball. Why? What, you know, those sort of conversations a coach or that needs to have. But, you know, as you know, everyone's so busy 10 months on the road playing other forms, they don't get that opportunity.
So as a coach, the guy that fascinates me, and I love watching him play, every time he walks out to bat or bowl or in the field, is Maxwell. Like,
yes.
You know,
what a superstar.
Well, he's just, and he's a lovely chap. And some days he goes out there and he amazes you by the way he plays, and other times he goes out there and amazes you by the way he gets out. If you're coaching him, what are you saying to Glenn Maxwell?
Same sort of things as what I'd say to Finchie, only because I know him personally and I played golf with him and batted with him. And it was sort of one of the reasons why he came to the Stars actually as well. We'd sort of left the Renegades and gone to the Stars, and Maxie was one of those four that went there at the start with Finchie, and he said, you know, Finchie was never going to be there. And he goes, oh, I want to come to the Stars as well, you know, with Hodgie and stuff. And those personal friendships are really, really cool. And as a coach, that was the hardest thing in it. A couple of the times where I had to break free to know that I'm not a player anymore and I have to show the authority that I am the coach and talk on a different level. But for Maxie, I really don't think that anyone around the world has got the best out of him at all. Such a talent. But you've got to understand that if you play a high-risk game, you're going to have some things which are questionable to people. But if you deliver 3 out of 10 times in a competition, then that's good enough.
That's the number, 3?
Yeah, I reckon. Most players sort of have an impact 1 in 4. If you're a superstar, you'll have an impact 1 in 3. So whatever that impact is, it's a game-changing impact. You know, it might be 30 off 12 balls or it might be 70 off 45. Might be 10 off 3.
Yep.
Just an impact which wins a game. And Max is that type of player. He's not the type of player which, you know, is a Khawaja and he'll bat through the Big Bash and not get out for less than 30. It's just not the way his style is. He's a match winner and you've got to take the good with the bad, for sure. But he's just like anyone. He just needs a little bit of love and a little bit of care and attention. He's just like a flamboyant racing car, you know? Yeah, make sure the tyres are at the right pressure and everything's under control and out you go onto the racetrack and give it your all. You know, that's the type of beast that he is. You know, he doesn't really care about what the figures say, you know, what the track temperature is or whatever it is. He's just out there trying to hit the cricket ball as best he possibly can on that day.
And you've been really good with your time and I know you've got to go now and sit around
and
for 7 hours.
Sit around and do nothing.
Before
and,
you train tonight.
Yep, absolutely. Training, well, I'm not even sure I'll be doing that.
We had this discussion last night. One player you can pick at the Gujarat Lions. So it doesn't matter who you're playing for. If there's one player in T20 world cricket, who's the first player you pick?
Yeah, I said Andre Russell.
Yeah, and then he walked into the restaurant as well.
Didn't he? Wasn't it? Yeah, wasn't it a weird, surreal experience when we just mentioned probably the one player you'd pick in the world and you probably played 2.5 million for him and there he was walking in like Superman.
And gave us all hugs and cuddles. He was very warm.
Maybe he knew.
He smelt nice. Yeah. He's a massive man, isn't he? I don't think people realise like the size or the physical stature of some of the West Indian guys like Gale and Andre Russell.
I really think it's one of them things which you're actually going to struggle to keep up with. You know, and you look at Majak Dawe, you know, when he's on the field for North Melbourne, you just see the strength and the body size of this guy is amazing. And these guys have that physical presence. They just muscle the ball so far. I really think that it's an area which we're going to actually fall down in Australian cricket. Yeah, yeah. I think we're going to have to find a way to try and catch up to that. And maybe it is through our training and skill or take our skill level to another level. But these guys just muscle the ball.
It's brutal, aren't
it? It's brutal. It just goes out of the park.
The other night, Russell at Sabina Park, two top edges that both went for six.
Yeah.
Like top edges.
Yeah, the bat speed, I mean, that's the thing. The only person I know that can actually do that in Australia is probably Glenn Maxwell with that bat speed. You know, we're very much more traditional side. You know, Warner, Finch, these guys. That's why Finch and Warner are vitally important to the Australian T20 setup, because everyone knows that their two guys can actually whack it out of the park consistently. And they're not big human beings, but they are big in Australian cricket in terms of their physical strength and physical presence, but we don't have enough of them here. You walk out and they're everywhere. Dynamic cricketers. We were talking about the talent pool, and it's a shame to see the Test cricket and how poor they are, and how unattractive that is for them, and to play T20 and then see the opposite of it's almost like you know, it is the Usain Bolt. It's the 100-meter dash, and flamboyant. We're the big dogs in this sport at the moment, and they are. And we can't catch them.
As someone was saying to me again at this tournament, it doesn't matter who it was, but they were telling me that one of the West Indian senior players came back from the last Test tour of Australia after tax with, I think, 8,000.
Yeah, it's not great.
$8,000 in their pocket.
Yeah,
in front. These guys are getting. There's no choice.
And that's the reality. That's why they don't want to play.
But they don't have a choice, really. If not someone said to me, this network's going to offer you 25 times as much to go and work for them, you're not even going to think about it, are you?
No, you're not. And that's the reality. And that's unfortunate where their players' union's fallen down as well. I think from memory, someone was telling me that they used to get paid, I think, $15,000 US a test match, and now it's down to $5,000.
Right.
And I think the only way to actually fix that is to unify Test match cricket payment across the board, because it is all entertainment.
Equalisation.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that if you're whoever you are, Carlos Brathwaite, and you're entertaining Test cricket, you should get paid exactly the same amount as Mitchell Marsh on field. Don't worry about salaries and so forth. But if you take the field, if we unify a Test match payment that it's $15,000 US across the board, then I'm sure you'll get a few people sticking their hand up to go, you know, hey, 150 grand across 10 Test matches is pretty good. If I can fit that in around IPL, and that's great. But that's the one thing. The one thing that sort of did kill the game of cricket was IPL, to know that, yeah, Sunil Narine gets $1.2 million to play and Pollard is about the same. These sort of guys, that why would they bother playing $5,000 and wreck their bodies for a game of cricket, which where they're not even engaged in anyway?
They'd be doing themselves and their family a disservice at the end of the day, wouldn't they? So
correct.
Where are we going to be in 20 years' time?
Well, I think it'll just be 2020 cricket with the odd test match of Australia versus England versus South Africa and India. That's probably about it. I really can't see how. The minnows of Zimbabwe and UAE and these guys, they're actually quite competitive in the shorter form of the game, and they just can't compete at all over the course of the 5 days. So them playing test match cricket is pretty much a waste of people's time. And West Indies probably falls into that category as well at the moment. So for me, for have a unified world competition and have those teams involved, then it has to be the shorter the better. Because you can have one guy that just comes out and has a good day, you know, say Paul Sterling for Ireland. He comes out and he smacks a quick fire 60 off 30, and you know, he can win a game. We've seen before Australia's been beaten in 2007 by Zimbabwe. We got beaten in Cape Town.
Mm.
So it can happen. The shorter the better for these minnows. But I sort of see the future. I look, and there's certain test match games I can't watch either. It's and, you know, I'm a student of the game, and I sit there and I think, my God, this is the most boring thing I've ever seen in my life. And, you know, only a decade ago, it was probably the most important thing to me. I'm not sure how we're going to improve it. Certainly like the Adelaide Test match was great. You know, the spice of the pink ball and the ball moving around a little bit and the atmosphere was great. Isn't that the best oval in the world at the moment? I like that. To me, that's Test match cricket. The players
have to embrace it, though.
They do. But that's what Test's about. Otherwise, just play white ball cricket and you smack it everywhere and we all average 35-plus and no one ever questions it. But the pink ball actually moves, or the red ball should move. That's the idea of Test match cricket, to be able to test your technique and test your mental aptitude. Not walk out there and see the ball not move for the whole game because Channel 9 want the game to go for 5 days because that's their advertising, right? Mm. It's boring as hell. It makes no sense to me at all. It's a poor product if that happens. And sooner or later after day three, I'm sure people turn the TV off and go and watch something else.
T20.
Yeah, absolutely. T20.
Yeah.
Correct.
Bradley, you've been very generous with your time. Hodgie, Dodgeball, Bunky. It's been good to chat with you, mate. You've been honest and open. How are you going to feel on the rest of your day before training?
I've been trying. I'm going to hustle down some golf courses here in Florida. I'm going to put some pressure on the Marriott to try and get me on board there. If not, she's going to be another lonely day of reading another fiction novel.
Couple of movies?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think I'm in the books phase at the moment. I go through phases on tour where I just read.
What are you reading?
At the moment, I just finished a book. This one's called The Black House. It's sort of a thriller, murder mystery.
Out of 5 stars, what are we giving it?
Well, I've only just started this one. I just finished one called The Memory Man by David Baldolci, and it was an excellent book, actually.
5 stars? 4 stars?
Yeah, 4.5. Okay. Really good, really good. So we'll see where this one gets me.
Appreciate your time, mate.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks, Howie.
Cheers, mate. Hodgie, superstar. Another cricket superstar next Thursday on the Howie Games. That's all you need to know. Until then, peace and love, and enjoy the Big Bash.
And we can do it if we try, try, try. If we try, try, try. If we try, try, try.
Listener.